Welcome to Politics in Question, a podcast about how our political institutions are failing us and ideas for fixing them. My name is James Wallner, and I'm a senior fellow at the R Street Institute and a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Clemson University.
And I'm Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at New America.
And listeners, with us today, he's back. I know you've all been waiting for him. It's been a while. We've been waiting. But guess what? He's here. The one and only Matt Glassman. Guest host extraordinaire. Welcome, Matt.
How you doing, fellas? It's great to be here. I love nothing more than talking to you guys because you guys actually talk about big things and I love it.
All right. Well, we love having you.
Right. We were talking about Starship people before this we hit record. So big things. Starship and how much Matt loves Starship. And Peter Cetera as well. Let's not forget. So today we're going to sit here, and Lee and I, and we're just going to listen to Matt because he's a very smart guy, clearly. But no, we can't just sit here. You know, Lee and I can't just sit here and be quiet. But I want to ask a question. Let's just start off and let's just ask a question. Just one question. We always ask about politics and why it's dysfunctional and how it's dysfunctional. But like, how do you do politics? Like, what's the right way to do politics? Is there a right way to do politics? Or do we read into politics kind of our own biases about how things ought to work? And I don't know, Matt, as the smartest and handsomest person in the virtual room here, I'm going to kick it over to you first.
Well, I mean, I think that everybody has their own boundaries for what is legitimate, illegitimate in politics. And I think in most of the Western democracies, certainly people pick up boundaries that I think are common to almost everyone, where sort of violence isn't an appropriate part of politics, nor should be sort of physical intimidation or things like that, even though those sometimes do seep into our politics. They are sort of seen as out of bounds. But then there's sort of smaller fences people bring in. And it's one of the things that does bother me about our politics right now is I think there's a lot of trying to police how people practice politics at the level of political style, which I don't think personally is appropriate. It can be the biggest pain in the ass to deal with the guy at the PTA meeting who's the crank, who sits there and just complains and just tells you that he has all the simple solutions and he never wants to compromise. And the only reason he's there is because he likes coming and feeling like he's the smartest guy in the room and he's not actually going to be productive. But like, that's a political style you have to deal with. And there's nothing illegitimate about it. And to say, cure that by booting him out of the PTA meeting feels good, but it's really not sort of productive in the community democracy sense. And it's also not possible in some of our larger institutions, like our state and local governments or national governments, right? Those people get a say too. And so when people sort of police styles like that, I prefer styles that are sort of incremental bargaining, right? And mutual adjustment and working things out towards sort of consensus-oriented politics. I think that's particularly good at the local level, but it's not the only style. And when I watch sort of like the hardliners in Congress, be it sort of Ted Cruz or Elizabeth Warren, whoever, kick and scream and try and get their way by making people just want them to shut up and just give them what they want to get them to shut up. That's like the most natural thing I remember from all my days in local politics. Like, you're just annoying. You'll eventually get what you want a lot of the time. I mean, that's a reasonable style, too. And like, I'm using sort of style as the example, but I think like this can apply to a lot of different dimensions of politics. Some people think actual issues are out of bounds in democracies. Right. And I don't think that makes any sense. And the effort to sort of fence off issues is its own politics. And fencing off your issues as the ones that are legitimate and someone else's issues as the ones that are illegitimate is a very clever way. You might call it like a third face of power type style of making sure that politics only touches the things you want it to touch. And so, no, I don't think sort of like, you know, boundaries in politics internal to sort of the superstructure ones of the liberal democracies, which I think start with politics is conducted in a nonviolent manner and that it's a civil way to adjudicate differences. Outside of that, internal of that, I had a lot of trouble with the way people sort of wanted to take sort of actual platform items of Trump and say they were out of bounds in 2016, or the way a lot of conservatives want to talk about social democracy or socialism on the left being sort of out of bounds because that's, quote, not American or something. I don't really buy into any of that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that, except for the incremental stuff. It's kind of boring, Matt, this, you know, incremental bargaining stuff. No, I'm just, you know, it, I agree with all that, but I want to kind of frame it a little bit, and then let's talk about Congress and then get to the presidency as well. Lee's written an excellent Substack on, is that, did I say it right? Substack? Is that how you say it? The emphasis is on the stack. Substack.
That's one pronunciation, but, you know, this is America, so, you know, you can call it whatever you want. You can call it, Versailles, you know.
Substack.
So, Substack, yeah. I mean, I'm from South Georgia, so if I got it right, I can, you know, that's awesome. So I think what Matt's saying, to dumb it down to my level, is that, you know, politics is an activity, right? And it's a way in which we make collective decisions. And there's two ways to do that activity. You can do it by violence, or you can do it by kind of like bargaining and negotiation and all of the incremental stuff as well. And I think that's a key thing to keep in mind as you assess, and you have to kind of differentiate in your thinking about politics. And so you think about it on one hand as an activity that takes place in this location. It's something that we all participate in, which necessarily means that people we disagree with are going to come into that and argue with us. That's the point. And then we have to keep in mind that we have views and policies and things that make us passionate. We get out of bed in the morning and put our feet on the ground and try to win, right? That's why we're there, actually. That's why it matters. And when we look at Congress, I think it's very easy to see that. And like, but there's ways in which we think about politics that kind of, we say it has to be this way. It has to operate this way, not just on policy, but just in terms of how we do it or how we make sense of it. And we think about Congress in this past week, and the commentary on Congress, I think, is getting increasingly bad. It's getting worse. And this week, it's all about Congress's failure theater. And look, I'm going to be first tell you, it was not a pretty week for Congress. But when we talk about it as in Congress failed, well, you know, there's two outcomes in a debate or a vote. One side wins, one side loses. And it's the act of having the vote that makes it a failure, that makes it, it's the important, right? The outcome is the outcome. And I'm not sure how not impeaching, you know, the Homeland Security Secretary, however much you may want to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary, or choosing not to fund, you know, Ukraine's effort to defend itself against Russian aggression or Israel or the border, how any of those policy options somehow, by making that affirmative choice, they're somehow an indication of failure. I mean, I think it's super dysfunctional, but I think at a very base level, I mean, what am I missing here, Lee?
Well, we haven't talked about politics as representation, right? Modern mass democracy is also about representation, and it's about organization. It's about building majorities. And you build majorities by building winning coalitions. And I think so much of what I see happening in Congress is not people trying to build winning coalitions. It's people trying to tank things from happening. And you know, I think that is, to me, it's incredibly frustrating because I think there are a lot of serious problems that we expect our legislature to deal with. I think the collapse of the immigration deal is extremely frustrating. I mean, it's not something that's new. We've been trying to get an immigration deal for a decade and a half here. And it's very easy for disruptors in Congress to just kind of say, well, this isn't good enough. I'm gonna shoot this down. It's very hard to build a majority, and to particularly in a representative democracy, you know, where you've got to organize a winning coalition. And you know, so I feel like a lot of challenge in trying to decide on the boundaries of what's politics is deciding, are you actually trying to work together to build a winning majority, trying to build a winning coalition, trying to represent a larger coalition and build that winning coalition, or are you just trying to undermine that? And you know, I think there is a lot of activity in Congress that is really about undermining these fundamental challenges of governing, and governing is a part of politics. Congress is an arena for politics. These podcasts and conversations that people have are an arena for politics. Elections are an arena for politics. Lobbying is an arena of politics. Like, there are a lot of different ways in which politics happens at a lot of different levels, but ultimately, you know, politics is about trying to solve problems where we don't all agree what the solution is, because if we all agreed, then these wouldn't be political issues.
Why is Lee wrong, Matt? Tell him why he's wrong.
I agree with you, James, at a very basic sense, in that I think there's too much dumping on congressional inaction as somehow wrong, right? If Congress takes an issue, considers it carefully for a period of months, and decides to do nothing, that's not a bad outcome, right? That's not a failure. And it really annoyed me when I worked at the Congressional Research Service, that one of the measures of how you did your job as an analyst was how influential you were on like laws that passed. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what if, you know, I'm working for someone who's trying to defeat something and it's defeated? Like, how is that not sort of like equally productive?
I took up so many hours of your colleagues' time trying to kill bills.
Yeah. And there is a mindset, and I associate it sort of with an educated liberal activist class that sees sort of government inaction as inherently failure. And I don't see it that way. Now, I do agree with Lee that there is a side of this that does have to be measured against sort of the substantive policy agenda of the public or of the representatives. And it does feel to me right now that there are sort of institutional and structural forces in Congress that are preventing massive majorities from achieving anything on a set of policies where it's clear huge majorities in Congress want something to be done. Now, that's not always bad, right? Sometimes you just can't agree and you move on and you wait till next Congress to deal with it. You try again tomorrow. You can always come back to it. But I do feel like the sort of failure of Congress to reflect sort of sentiment around some things does strike a failure that I can't just chalk up to like, well, it's okay if Congress does nothing. If they consider it and do nothing and they vote and the votes come out wrong, then like they have not failed at all. I can't say that that's true about something like the immigration bill, which I feel like across the spectrum was demanded action in Congress. And somehow we've gotten ourselves to the point where nothing's happening on it. And, you know, part of that is that Congress can be hijacked by hijacked, that's the wrong word. Congress can be small minorities that don't want to do something, who feel intensely, often win in our federal system. That's the nature of the structure of the system. But it does feel like the politics this week in Congress is indicative of something else. And I think about it like one of the things is I talked about that you want as a sort of the superstructure that I think is illegitimate is violence, right? And I think most people agree that we're inside the violence fence for how politics should be conducted. I also think inside the fence, you've got to have some baseline good faith commitment to the community. And that's true at the PTA meeting. Everyone has to care about the school. At some fundamental level, we have to agree we care about the school. If there's people there who are trying to ruin the school, right, you have a whole different problem, right? And I'm not saying there's people in Congress trying to ruin the country or ruin things, but I do think there are sort of, you know, cracks, and I can see things where there are people who are not necessarily on board with each other as part of the same community anymore. And not widespread, not like it was in the 36th Congress in 1859. But that is also sort of a really bad place to get in a collective decision-making process when there's people who no longer understand themselves as working in the same common community.
Well, and thinking about elections, and Lee, I'm going to pivot to you, but it doesn't seem like it's entirely new. I mean, Vietnam, it seems to me that the American people were way ahead of where the Congress was in terms of our involvement and engagement in Vietnam. And it took a while for Congress to kind of get there for whatever reason, for lots of different reasons. And this has happened time and time again. But Lee, what's different about this moment now? Or is there anything different? Or how should we be reading into what's going on?
Well, I think the big difference about this moment, and which is why I sometimes balk a little bit at the comparisons to the 1960s, is that one, our politics is much more nationalized, that there's much more attention on what happens in Congress, and so much of state and local politics is just an amplification of national politics as opposed to a separate space where you can work out different agreements. And two, our parties are just much more sorted from each other. That the Democrats were a broad coalition in the 1960s, 1970s of liberals and conservatives. Republicans were a broad coalition of liberals and conservatives. And these issues were really orthogonal to the political parties. Vietnam was somewhat orthogonal to the political parties. You know, civil rights was orthogonal to the political parties as they were in the 1960s and 1970s. So it wasn't that there was one party that was clearly on one side of this issue. Now, immigration is a somewhat complicated issue because I think there are divides and cracks within the parties, which is one reason why we're not seeing action. But the divisions are not there's not a second dimension to that conflict as there that cuts across the parties in unpredictable ways. And so I think that's why so much is locked in. And we're in this moment in which the majorities are so thin that it becomes very hard for leaders to operate, because if you lose just a few votes on your side, you've lost the vote. And that creates tremendous ability for just a small group of people to say, well, you don't have my vote unless X, Y, and Z happens. And then the whole process falls apart. So I think we're in a totally different political environment than we were 60 years ago. And so I it's why I just don't find a lot of these comparisons to, well, we did this this way in the 1960s. Why can't we do it again? Particularly convincing, because so much is different in our politics.
Matt, you just said something that was, I think, and Lee, you say stuff all the time, so I'm not going to, it's profound, so I'm not going to compliment you right this minute, but I'm sure I will before the episode is over. But Matt, you just said something I think that was very insightful, at least it got me thinking, and it helped me fill in a blank here in my own thought and stuff that Lee and I have talked a lot about. And that is this idea of, like, why aren't things, you know, the elections don't change. Lee has written like an extraordinary book on the two-party doom loop. And there's an Audible book, and I wish I wanted to be the guy who got to record it, but they wouldn't let me.
You can record your own bootleg version of it, James. Put it up on YouTube.
Yeah, so I might do that. You know, a little grainy sound or something. But when you said the commitment to the community, right? So one reason why the elections may not necessarily fix it, or we may be just lagging, right? It may be coming around the corner. But one difference between now and the 60s and 70s is, one, we have this two-party doom loop, right? Maybe. The other one is that this commitment to community, and I think this is key because there was a commitment in the 60s and 70s. And that is, if you think about Congress, for instance, Congress is a place where we go to achieve our goals. Everybody's pissed off. We got conservatives are pissed off, liberals are pissed off, everybody in between. And what are they doing? They're taking to the streets. They are acting in politics to try to win. They're going to Congress. They're mobilizing. And so Congress, in that sense, is anterior. It constitutes the community, if you will. And people see it as the place where you win. And so that creates a situation where you could have someone like a Jesse Helms or a Howard Metzenbaum, who are two very different people, who can still conceive of themselves as individuals and be able to work together if they ever need to, but also to be able to respect each other's rights and to defend the rules of Congress, which empower individuals to do things in Congress. Today, largely for lots of reasons that Lee, I think, has mentioned about the two-party doom loop, is we don't think about it that way. I don't think the members think about it in those terms anymore. And the voters don't necessarily think about it in those terms. And so that commitment has been eroded. And it's almost as if, like, it doesn't matter if it changes, right? It's a, you know, we now think that we're just going to just do what we want if we win an election. We got to get the presidency. We'll get the Supreme Court. And the Congress itself, or the community of politics, that give and take of politics seems to have fallen away in importance. We don't need to listen to you anymore. And, like, you're not in the community. I don't need you in my community. Why would I have you in my community? We didn't have a choice back then. We didn't have a choice before the Civil War. If you were for slavery or against slavery, you're, you know, Daniel Webster or John C. Calhoun, you're stuck together. And I think that community, I don't know exactly why that's the case, but I think thank you. That was very insightful. I don't have a question.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a sense of, among voters and I think among members now, of sort of a backwardsness in the role of elections in politics, for sure. And this is nothing new to you. I hear you say this too, James. But, like, the idea of wanting an issue instead of a policy is ancient, right? Like, we can find that all over the 19th century. Politicians not willing to cause bargains because they'd rather take the Fugitive Slave Act or whatever to the voters, or the lack of a Fugitive Slave Act to the voters, or here and there and things like that. And so, like, when it becomes clear as day to me that for a lot of Republicans in Congress right now, they don't want to fix the border because they'd rather have the issue in the fall. Like, that's not, like, new. It's not out of bounds. But it feels like it's creeping into contemporary politics in sort of an overt way that I would have never said was apparent in the 1990s. Like, members plainly talking about things like that. You know, it was always a strategy. You know, like, well, let's have an issue instead of a policy. But I never heard people just say it. And now you're hearing senators just say it. Well, yeah, we just want, you know, we want this for the campaign in the fall. And that strikes me as sort of built into this idea that someday your party is just going to steamroll the three branches and get massive supermajorities and just do whatever you want. And that's basically a pipe dream in American politics. But it fuels sort of this idea that, like, you know, it's a tough choice. Should we compromise now or just go to the election with this issue? It pushes people towards going to the election. And I do think that in comparative perspective, Americans seem obsessed with elections as sort of the core feature of democracy or the core feature of democratic politics. And like, to the point where if you ask people like, well, what is politics? They'll start talking about electoral politics as if that's the only or main piece of politics, right? I think of politics as much more about like sitting around at the HOA meeting, you know, arguing with someone and trying to come to a solution, right? Which has nothing to do with sort of electoral calculations. And so I don't know if that's sort of an increased focus on elections due to sort of tribal partisan politics, or it's just something about the nature of contemporary politics in America. But I do get this overriding sense that people are sort of geared around elections in a way that's probably unhealthy to sort of the politics, all the politics that takes place between the elections. And also, this is fueled by sort of this community sense. Like, I can't stand the notion of red states and blue states. I can't stand it. And not in like the Obama sense, oh, there's red states, blue states, we're the United States, but just in the idea.
But they don't exist.
What? They don't exist. There's not a community in this country that doesn't have 30% voting for the opposition party in every rank of election for the most part. And it's
not DC.
Well, yes. I said, yeah. I mean.
Well, and one, it's a snapshot in time. Two, it assumes that everybody's the same within that party and that they all agree on. I mean, there's so much nuance and stuff. And in the way we look at things and understand.
Well, this is when you impose an artificial binary on something that's much more complicated and variegated, you get politics that reflects the artificial binary and reifies the artificial binary.
But it still doesn't have to be conceptualized that way, because like the idea that like, you know, Montana is a red state and so is Texas and so is Alabama and so is Florida, like it flattens the politics within those places as well, right? And that's not inherently to partyism. It's something it's like pushing a national partyism onto a set of communities that don't see eye to eye on things that would ever paint them a singular color. And that frame, I think, drives a lot of people into sort of maybe not their own tribalism, but into a view of the opposition as like monolithic tribes. And I just look at the American parties, and like you can see all the European parties inside them. They're all there, right? You know, and AOC is in a different party than Biden, and they're both in different parties than Romney, who's a different party than Mike Lee, who's a different party than Trump, right? And the fact that they have to sort of organize ahead of the elections because of the nature of the electoral system doesn't change the fact that under those hoods, those people think very differently about politics, both as a process and as a set of substantive goals they're seeking as outcomes.
Yeah, and if we had a process, we would see a lot of that diversity kind of creep out. And I think that's one reason why a lot of people like AOCs and Mike Lees of the world, when I look at those two, I see the same person in terms of how they act in the institutions, because they are opposed to the status quo most of the time. And they have to go outside of the status quo to get leverage. They try to stop whatever the status quo is trying to do because their policy position is opposed to that. They want to change it. And they have to engage in the kinds of things that we kind of demonize today. And we say, this is not allowed. But I don't know is that wrongly?
Although they've both made concessions within their parties to try to rise up in the ranks.
Well, right? Of course, that's the thing. And people on the, you know, their left and right will criticize them or not. Are they selling out? I mean, this is like, goes back to like, you know, punk rock in the early, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. And he's selling out over here. Look at that guy. He got a record contract. Green Day just came out with another album. I'm like, Green, what? They sold out a long time ago.
I heard it was actually good. I haven't listened to it yet.
It's pretty good. Yeah.
Right, but I mean that's building, that's building towards a majority coalition, right? Like you can only get so far being the person who's, you know, has 10% of the people behind you, right? You've got to build the majority coalition somehow. Problem is when you have these long coalitions that we have where there's no fluidity, right? Because there are, if you unleashed the process as, you know, you describe it, then, you know, you would see additional dimensions emerge across different issues. But the problem is everybody's scared of unleashing the process because the structure of our elections is organized around this idea of getting total control. It's an illusion. It's elusive, but the entire electoral apparatus is, well, our side needs total control because their side's trying to get total control.
Real quick, I'm going to come right back to you because this gets into your Substack. But I want to give a great anecdote, a concrete example, rare on Politics in Question. This is like something, like an actual thing, people. This is tangible. Get out your pens. You ready? No, what Lee just said is very true, and it is. The fluidity is extraordinary. And for instance, when I was in the Senate, when I worked for the steering committee, and I was helping Mike Lee and Rand Paul on the USA Freedom Act, and we were working with Pat Leahy and Ron Wyden, and our opponents were the president and Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, and a bipartisan kind of swath of people. And it's not just like one random issue, and we may say, well, that's just this kind of weird libertarian kind of privacy thing. You get this on like tax policy, you get it, I mean, on every issue. If there were just these kind of, if you had a process that was allowed for these divisions to emerge, I think the problem is that, again, what Lee says with this perception of we have to be unified to win elections, and so therefore we can't have these types of debates. We can't have these types of things because we as a party are running. We as a party need to win. We need to have all of these seats. Is that wrong? I mean,
if I jump in here, I think there's something to that, of course. But I also think because of the nature of the electoral politics, members of Congress, other elite officials have a incentive to promote the issues that cause those divisions. Like, tax policy isn't really that partisan, like, generally speaking. It's just not.
Well, but that's the conundrum, right? I mean, before the Civil War, it's like, let's not talk about slavery. This is why, you know, Clay is always compromised. It's like, get it off the agenda as quickly as possible. Why? Because it divides both of the parties. And you have a group of people who are trying to put it on the agenda. And the party structure is saying no. And it's organized institutionally and informally to keep it off the agenda. Today, we have these issues that divide the parties, like immigration and others. But instead of like not talking about them, it's like we talk about them all the time. But then we know that when we get to Congress, we're not going to actually adjudicate them. We're going to just go through the motions and we're going to act like we're doing it so that we can go back and talk about them. And that creates this big disconnect between us and the electorate. And it creates a lot of apathy and frustration, I think. It's not a good...
I mean, I was thinking about sort of not the opposite case, but the inverse, which is like immigration is getting all the attention right now because there is sort of this partisan some sort. But like the tax bill is like just sort of came out of nowhere after a year, like with no fanfare or whatever, and just moved through the House on like a big bipartisan basis. And there's nothing sort of, it's not really sort of electorally powerful when you have a big bipartisan tax bill that like everyone gets a piece of and people are like, yeah, you know, it's pretty good compromise here, right? It's not going to be the stuff of contemporary electoral politics if contemporary electoral politics is built around sort of tribal animosity and the other side is the devil, right? You're not gonna be able to sell a tax bill, right? There might be a collective incentive to do it in a prisoner's dilemma sense, where if like everyone got up and trumpeted this tax bill, people might have more sort of like, you know, belief in the ability of Congress to adjudicate problems. But not only are the things that are elevated the tougher things where there's headbutts, but the things that actually do look like a functioning Congress, which I think this tax bill does very much so, are just suppressed, right? And that's different than suppressing slavery, right? That's different than suppressing sort of the conflict that can't be settled, right? This is sort of suppressing the things that show sort of a harmonious common community coming together to say, well, everyone's got a different opinion on taxes, so let's divvy out pieces here and come up with something everyone can live with.
But it's also a distinct kind of distributive policy where there's something in it for everyone.
Agreed.
And there are a lot of business lobbying organizations that are trying to work to get these bills passed.
This is where we interrupt for an ad from Goldman Sachs. Let's tell the Fed to stop the raid on small business capital standards, something. I don't know. That's what I hear on all these podcasts.
Can we get that? Can we get their sponsorship?
Yeah, we'll see.
Are we going to sell out, James?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I think.
To big banks. Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about Lee's paper, or Lee's new Substack, because it's great and I think it's really relevant to this discussion. So Lee, you want to give us the overview?
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. So I wrote a Substack. My Substack is called Undercurrent Events. It's free, so you don't have to pay. It's not one of these where I'm trying to get your money. Just, you know, you can enjoy it for free. And you know, I question this idea of whether Biden is unfairly being harmed by people not recognizing that the economy is good, or whether, you know, he will eventually benefit from a better economy. And I looked at the data, very simple scatter plot. Take monthly presidential approval and consumer price index as a proxy for the economy. And you know, for a long time, there was a relationship, right? You know, the economy is doing better. Presidential approval goes up. The economy is doing worse. Presidential approval goes down. But for the last 20 years, the relationship has been pretty much flat. In fact, it even is a little bit inverted in the data. And it struck me as, well, this is weird because we go through our political analysis assuming that Biden's fortunes or any incumbent's fortunes depend on the state of the economy, when in reality, there are different realities. And if you think Biden is a good president, you're going to think he's good and it doesn't matter about the economy. If you think he's a bad president because you're of the opposite party, no economic news will convince you that he's worth your approval. And if you're of the roughly 20% of the electorate, which I have called the shrug emoji voters, you know, you sort of think they're all terrible. And yeah, you know, so you've already convinced yourself that anybody who's been in Washington too long is bad, and you're sort of disconnected from the news more broadly. So that's not going to register. So this idea that we have that there's this particular relationship between the economy and presidential approval, you know, is really based on a particular set of circumstances about how politics worked in a particular moment. And we're in a different political environment. So we should understand the relationships that exist in the current political environment, not try to impose a past expectation on current reality.
Boom, there it is. That's the profound thing. I knew you were going to come through on me.
All right. I was building up to it.
No, it's a great point. And a quick question, though, on the data, and I typically don't like to dwell in the data. I like to keep my head in the clouds. But does the economy, in your sense, does it affect things like turnout? Does it affect the ability and the enthusiasm of a coalition to kind of come together in support of that president as opposed to approval, disapproval?
I don't think so. I don't see any evidence for that. I mean, of course, when you're dealing with individual presidential elections, there's so little data and so many confounding variables. But at least with the presidential approval, you have many more data points. So,
you know, the beauty of what you're showing is just like, it's so simple. But I can remember in 2000 election, I just started graduate school in political science. And I can remember like the economic models for predicting the national vote share were like amazing because you could use like three variables and come very close to the predicted Democratic vote share. And the variables were not like particularly like specific, right? They were like, what was the, you know, growth rate of the economy, you know, three quarters before the election, what was the unemployment rate? And boom, and you plug them into a model and you've got a pretty straight line with a lot of explanatory power. And it seemed like it had always been that way because it was really sort of a post-war phenomenon, which is when sort of social science data of this type became readily available and good across all ways. And it just seemed like it would last forever. And that's what I think the beauty of Lee's Substack piece is in sort of a meta sense, is that it gets at this idea that politics changes. And no matter how much you believe in sort of an understanding of politics, that understanding can be gone in a flash and be wrong. And if you hold on to these old understandings, you're sort of going to be angry and frustrated. And it leads you into weird places. Like, how come, you know, people won't give Biden credit for the economy, right? Like, the economy's great. Why won't people give Biden credit? Like, they don't have to give Biden credit for the economy. They don't have to care. And it reminds me of that book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which I always disliked because I thought the underlying thesis was dumb. And the underlying thesis was there's a way to look at the world politically and they don't do it the right way. And what was the matter with Kansas is that they didn't look at politics the same way the author did. And that doesn't mean it's not an interesting book. Like, why does Kansas have cultural politics instead of economic politics? It's a very interesting question. But the title was so sort of demeaning, I thought, and came from a worldview that said politics works a very specific way. And I think you're absolutely right, Lee, that what people need to do is try and understand our political moment, and to the degree that they don't, to the degree they're still stuck in sort of an economic left-right spectrum as the core dividing line in politics, it is bad for, you know, elite actors, be them in the media or in government or just surrounding things, because it means you're not really understanding sort of the democratic polity right now.
Yeah, that brings us, I mean, that brings us back full circle to the beginning, which is when you think about politics as an activity, you may still have a hard time understanding the way in which it's operating today versus yesterday. But you are more accepting of the fact that there is no one right way to do it, that it's going to change constantly. That's the whole point of the activity. If it didn't, then we'd overthrow it and we'd be back with rulers and, you know, in violence. So I think it's really important. It's something that's hard. It's hard for me to do. I think there's only one way to do the Senate. No, there's not. There's no one way to lead. There's no one way to understand elections. There's no one way to understand how presidents get elected. And they are going to change over time. And I think recognizing and being comfortable with that flux is what I take out of Lee's paper. It's like the Substack. This Substack is the importance of being comfortable with the fluidity and the disequilibrium, because after all, that's kind of the point.
Right. And yeah, I mean, you can think of politics as having certain laws. And I think that's the way a lot of political science was taught to me once upon a time, that, you know, well, politics is a science and we can derive laws. And well, I mean, there are certainly patterns in politics, but you know, politics is a dynamic system, right? I mean, it's a complex dynamic system with a lot of interacting parts, and there are moments in which you can have stable equilibria, but those equilibria, what looks to be an equilibrium at the surface, is really suppressing a lot of disequilibrium below the surface, and eventually that disequilibrium breaks through. I mean, for me, the book that I liked most in graduate school was the Agendas and Instability by Baumgartner and Jones' book, which, you know, I felt like it really understood that politics is about these periods, you know, that there's a particular arrangement that works for a particular period, and you can derive patterns about how people interact under you know, a particular set of expectations, and then at some point that system flips and you're in a very different world in that particular policy subsystem. And, you know, when I think about history, and historians are very wary of having any laws of history, because they see how, you know, in different periods there are different dynamics. And, you know, I think it's you know, it's all people interacting with people, and, you know, people are somewhat unpredictable and dependent on what other people do.
Yeah, I think there's also sort of a component about this, and I think a mistaken idea that a lot of observers in DC and elsewhere, sort of high information voters, feel about politics. And that's the idea that sort of things like voter sentiment are sort of manufactured by elites in a way that's totally controllable. And if you can just win sort of a messaging battle, you can decide what politics is about and it will seep down to voters. And I just don't think that's right. I just don't think that's right. I don't think like the fact that politics right now is on sort of a, well, I would say more of a cultural axis than an economic axis, or at least more than it was a generation ago, is sort of due to sort of purposeful action of the political parties. Like, so you might write a story that the Republican Party won because they've got everyone talking about cultural issues like immigration instead of about economic issues where the Democrats have a better advantage, or about healthcare or whatever, right? And I'm not sure that's right, because I agree with Lee's view that there's a much more complicated set of dynamics underpinning sort of the machine here. I always think about there's a little political cartoon in 1995, right after the Republicans won control of the House and the Senate for the first time in God knows how long, the House in 40 years. And it was sort of like a reporter standing on the street next to two people who looked pretty down on their luck, like desolate, maybe one of them was unemployed. And they say to the reporter, what we'd really like this year is a balanced budget amendment. And the whole point of the cartoon was that, like, nobody thinks this way. What they actually want is sort of like economic redistribution that can help them get a job, right? And that might have been very well true in the moment. But I always remember thinking, like, what if the best people really did want a balanced budget amendment? Like, what if politics really wasn't that dimension where, like, that's what people wanted? Or at least what if what they wanted wasn't what was represented in the cartoon, right? Where they cared more about a lot of other things besides sort of their material conditions. And I do think that, like, material conditions are a huge driver of human behavior and always sort of a factor in politics. But, like, cartoons like that very much come out of the mindset that we are in sort of a economic fight in Western democratic politics, and that's the way Western democratic politics go. And I just don't believe it.
I mean, and that was the central dimension for a while when politics was really class-based, but politics is also about status. and it's about belonging. And you know, there's a wonderful book by Kathy Kramer, Politics of Resentment, where she spends a lot of time in rural Wisconsin trying to understand what people in rural Wisconsin think and what it means to be somebody with a rural identity. And you know, she talks about the politics of economics, and she says, well, you know, it's not just about money, it's about how people feel that they are being treated. And you can't really separate those things out. And if people feel like they are being disrespected, or people feel like their sense of their status is being put down, you can't just buy them off with money or with jobs programs. People have to feel a sense that of self-worth and belonging. And I mean, and there is a broad crisis in this country of loneliness and people feeling disconnected from communities and people feeling socially isolated that I don't think can be separated from our politics. But, you know, and you know, I think there's been some reflection among Democrats of this question around deliverism, you know, whether it's just about delivering economic policies or whether it's also, you know, about recognizing these fundamental human needs for status and belonging and recognition. But I
would even add in there, like, sort of like the politics of just of values, right? Like, I think that there's a tremendous number of pro-life people in this country who are so happy about the Dobbs decision. And even if you showed them, which is essentially true now, that the number of abortions in America really hasn't changed much, right? And marginally may have dropped a few percentage points, but like the Dobbs decision is not sort of like particularly like important towards sort of changing sort of abortion culture in America, but they still want their government to stand for certain things. And they want their government to stand not for sort of like abortion. And I totally get that. And I don't think it's any different than, you know, being okay with slavery where it exists in the South, but not wanting the government to endorse slavery in these new Western territories. Like, that's not what our government believes in, right? And wanting to do symbolic things like ban slavery in the New Mexico territory where there will never be a slave, right? That will do any productive work, right? Or banning the slave trade in DC and things. That matters. And that the values of the government are something that is reasonable for people to want out of their public politics.
I think it gets back to this idea of just, we've lost sight of the richness of politics. We've lost sight of if you think of the suffrage movement and the decades and decades and decades how long it took, right? It was a big deal, but also involved like temperance, involved economic concerns, it involved slavery, it involved all of these different dimensions, all of these different things. And it's not just one thing at any one time. I mean, I think there may be a dominant one, but you're going to have opponents trying to manipulate the other ones to try to defeat you, right? I mean, that's just the way that it works. That's how you defeat bills. That's how you defeat causes. But I'm going to give it to you, Lee, to close us out here. We've been going here for a little bit, and I think we've answered all the questions in the universe. I think we've figured out the truth, but I'm going to give it over to you and then maybe let Matt have the last word, or you guys figure it out. You guys negotiate amongst yourselves.
I want to hear what Matt has to say.
I mean, I think like one downstream danger of our current political moment is that the sort of tribalism and the partisanship and all the rest lead people to accept utterly suboptimal outcomes from the people that they agree with, who they've elected to represent them. And I think this is true of how people evaluate members of Congress. And knock on wood, I think it's absolutely true about what people put up with in the nomination systems for the presidency. And, you know, people will grouse all they want about Biden and Trump and how old they are and how maybe mentally incompetent they are and how insane they are. But ultimately, they'll pull the lever because it's less important than other things. And that's sort of a corrosive factor of this. There are so many people in the United States Congress right now who I think fundamentally are worse at doing their job on any dimension you can imagine than a previous class of representatives, who are less attuned to their constituents, who are less interested in solutions, and who just don't want to put the time into it. And they get to skate by because they have a label next to their name. And so I don't think like there isn't sort of, you know, it's a different politics now, but I don't think we can just say it's not worse in some ways. I think it is worse in some ways. And I think for all we've said about how politics changes and you have to adapt to that, I don't think that means you should be a cultural sort of relativist about it. And I'm happy to say that there's a lot of things about politics right now that are bad. And that would be how I would lead this, because I don't want to give people the impression that's like, well, politics is different. You got to adapt to it. It's always going to be different. And that means it's always like, it's not better or worse. It's just different. I don't think that's inherently right. I think there's something right now that is definitely worse in many ways than the politics of a generation ago.
That's an excellent, excellent point. And listeners, come back next week as we continue to lead you around and over the rocky shoals of mediocrity. But I think that is an excellent, excellent point to end on. So thank you, Matt, for joining us. Thank you, Lee, for your Substack. And this has been another episode of Politics in Question.
Thank you for listening to Politics in Question. This podcast is a joint production between New America and the R Street Institute. Our producer is Sarah Jacob. Our audio engineer is Shannon Lynch. Theme music composed and performed by yours truly. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.